Get your advanced PhD in WOW from Floor and Decor. If you're a pro, you're already an expert in tile, wood, and stone. And with Floor and Decor's job site delivery, their free design services, and pro rewards that actually reward you, your business is set to grow from one client to the next. Floor and Decor isn't just a couple of aisles. It's an entire store designed to help your business boom. It's Floor and Decor.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. Well, we're in the middle of a presidential campaign here in the U.S., and once again, commentators, politicians, reporters, they're bemoaning the apathy and disengagement of young Americans. But there was a time in American history when young people were the most passionate participants in American democracy. And no, it wasn't the 1960s. It was the 1860s. My guest today on the podcast has just published a book about 19th century politics and the energy that young voters brought to the process and how young people, particularly young men in the 19th century, looked to politics for a sense of manhood and adult identity during a time of economic and social upheaval. His name is John Grinspan, and his book is The Virgin Vote, How Young Americans Made Democracy Social, Politics Personal, and Voting Popular in the 19th Century. And on today's episode, John and I discuss why politics was an essential part of male identity in the 19th century and how a man's first vote was an important rite of passage into manhood during this time. And we also get into the atmosphere of campaigns in the 19th century America. And if you think this current election cycle is unprecedented in its violence, nastiness, and general circus-like environment, wait until you hear about the booze-laden, torch-lit midnight campaign barbecues and the shankings and brawls that happened at the polls during the 19th century. Some pretty crazy stuff. After the show, make sure to check out the show notes at aom.is/virginvote. We'll find links to resources, things we mentioned, so you can delve deeper into this topic. John Grinspan, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So you got a new book out about a part of American history that a lot of people don't know about. It's called The Virgin Vote, How Young Americans Made Democracy Social, Politics Personal, and Voting Popular in 19th Century. And it's one of the most fascinating books I've read this year so far, because it gets into a part of American history that I love, is the 19th century up until about the early 20th century. And it's about politics, which is pertinent because we're in an election year. And I guess my first question is, you know, a lot of people have been saying about this current presidential election, that it's unprecedented in its violence, its nastiness, you know, and its general circus-like atmosphere. As someone who has studied and written a book on the politics of the past, is this true? Have we devolved from a time when elections were sober and upright and, you know, very like Greek column-esque? What were elections like during the 19th century?
Yeah, I think people say that about this election, and this is certainly a weird one, but that's only because we're used to the incredibly quiet, boring political culture of 20th century America. That if you go back and you look at 19th century America, politics is the biggest, loudest, most important thing that's going on, and political events and campaigns are the center, not just of political culture deciding who governs a country, but are the center of entertainment culture that drive these big campaigns, these midnight rallies with torches, these bonfires. That there's a good side and a bad side to this. On the one hand, they do a great job getting many, many people involved, many more than today. Turnout was, you know, often over 80%, and many of those people are young, unlike today. But, you know, it also brings out a lot of stupidness and violence, and people get stabbed and shot at every election in the 19th century, and there are riots, and there are people who don't understand the issues they're voting for and vote the wrong ways and that kind of thing, too. So it's a very different world back then.
Yeah, I mean, you painted this picture, and it just sounded like it was not like a big party. Like campaigns and election day was just a big party, because not only were there torch lit, you know, marches in the street at night, but there was like the parties would put out these big barbecues. That was a tradition where they'd roast a pig. Alcohol, giving out alcohol was, you know, that was part of the election or campaign process.
Yeah, this, I mean, you have to remember these campaigns are doing two jobs at the same time. On the one hand, they're trying to win power, basically. And so these parties give out whatever they can to win. I mean, they often buy votes for $2 or $5, but it's cheaper just to get voters medium drunk. You don't want to get them so drunk that they forget to vote, but you want to get them 2 drinks, 3 drinks, a couple glasses of whiskey, a couple glasses of beer to get them to vote on your side. And at the same time, politics is American entertainment and American popular culture. This is a new country. This is a very shaken up country. There are a lot of people migrating from Europe and from different parts of America. And there's no central culture that ties everything together, except for the basically federal political campaign. I mean, America is a rural nation that doesn't have that much entertainment back then. And so if it's September or October of an election year, and the party's going to have a rally in town, you go to that and you hang out all night and you drink and you shout and maybe you throw some bricks at the other side, maybe you don't. But it's really the center of popular culture at the time.
Right. And you even talk about in the book when there'd be Europeans that would come over and see this. I mean, their response was like, yeah, Plato is right. Like, democracy just brings out the worst in people.
Yes, people are shocked. They're shocked by two things. One, they're shocked by how wild and crazy American politics is, and a lot of them see it as a sign that democracy just doesn't work. And the other is they're shocked by American young people, because American culture is also in many ways more democratic on the ground, and there's a lot less, there's still hierarchies. We would be surprised today by the distinctions, but compared to Europe back then, there's a lot more kind of freedom of action of young people. And so at every level of political campaigns in society, you see children, young adults, youths, 20-somethings are involved really actively. The idea that children were to be seen and not heard is kind of a fiction. The young people are the loudest part of these political campaigns.
Yeah, and that's the main premise of your book, is talking about how young people were really the driving force of this democratic ethos or fire that hit America during the 19th century. And as you said, like, voting was about 80% voter turnout was, and a lot of it was young people. But as you just said, this political activism or this involvement in politics began in young people even before they could vote. So what were young people who were doing, like 7 or 8 or even 17, what were they doing to get involved in the political process, even though they weren't old enough to vote? Because at the time, it was 21 years old, right?
Yes. And obviously, many Americans, the majority, weren't allowed to vote. But there's still ways that if you're a woman, if you're African American, a place where African Americans can't vote, and if you're underage, you can still be really involved because politics is so social. And that starts at a really young age. As you said, people raise their children from birth to identify with the political party of their family and to really see it as the institution they belong to, almost the way we raise kids with sports teams today. They, just as people are Eagles fans or Cowboys fans today, people were Whigs or Democrats or Republicans back then. And it builds over time. One of the reasons they get young people so involved and they get such great turnouts is because they layer this interest in politics over many years. Kids are taught to go to celebrations and to rallies, and they chant slogans in school, and then they kind of become errand boys and run errands for the political campaigns. They give out ballots on election day, or they bring liquor to the campaign headquarters, and they just, from a very young age, they get involved in politics, so that by the time they're 21, they are veterans. They've been in politics for years and years and years, whether they can vote or not.
And you talk about in the book that you'd even have young people, as young as 17, doing speeches at political rallies, rallying up the voters, even though they couldn't vote. Like, they were really supremely invested in this, and to the point where they were persuading even adults who could vote.
Yeah, there was this tradition of boy orators. And you have to remember, America back then is a speechifying nation. People love giving speeches and hearing speeches. There's obviously no TV or radio, and it's really seen as an art. And so kids are raised to give speeches to each other and to adults. And it's not uncommon in an election campaign to go to a town square and see 50, 60, 70-year-olds standing around listening to a 12 or a 15-year-old give a speech on the political issues of the day. They get this great training that connects them to politics and also gives them something to do and a sense of agency and involvement. There's nothing that, as they say, tickles the vanity of a young man besides more than giving a big public speech with adults listening. in the years after the Civil War in the South during Reconstruction, young African Americans who were born as slaves get really into speech making for the Republican Party. And it's this, it's an amazing culture that people who were born in slavery are within a few years making speeches and being listened to as candidates by adults.
And one of the arguments you make in the book, you know, one of the reasons kids got involved, because there was this culture there and it was fun, right? You could go to these campaign parties, these rallies, eat some food, meet with people. Because this is, you know, this is, again, like you said, America was a rural country this time. So this was like the one time people got together and you can actually meet other kids your age and have some fun in the process. But you also argue that besides the fun, young people in America, and one of the reasons why they got so heavily involved in politics is that politics offered them something, like a way to advance themselves personally. Can you explain a little bit what you mean by that? I mean, how was it that how is it that politics could help fulfill personal ambitions of young people during the 19th century?
I think it goes back to the predicament that young people find themselves in the 19th century, that this is a period when it's really hard, especially to go from childhood to adulthood, that the 19th century is this great shaken-up period in American history. At the beginning of this era, there are 5 million people in America. At the end, there are 75 million. It goes from agriculture to industry and from country to city, and millions of immigrants are pouring in. And the whole, and they're boom and busts all the time. There are depressions that hit young people particularly hard. It's really hard to find the path to maturity for these young people. They have trouble finding jobs. They have trouble finding mentors. The marriage age is rising, so they have trouble finding husbands or wives. They move around a lot, so they feel very unstable. There's a lot of uncertainty for 15 or 18 or 22-year-olds, for men and for women. And so they can gravitate to the political system as a source of ambition and identity and involvement. Maybe they can't get a job, but they can give a speech for the party, or they can march, or they can organize an event. It's this kind of artificial sense of adulthood when everything else in their life seems kind of blocked.
Yeah, that part in particular was really interesting, because we often have this mistaken idea, or this idea that, you know, kids these days, these 20-somethings, right, these millennials, you know, they don't know what they're doing with their lives. They're still living at home with your parents. Like, they just need to get on with their life. And, you know, you read millennial blog posts, or just like, I don't know what I'm gonna do with my life. Maybe I'll intern at a publisher and, you know, find my calling. And we often think that people back then in the 19th century, like, they had it all figured out. Like, they knew, they had like a certain sense of steadiness about them. But the picture you paint, that, like you just said, like, these young people in their 20, you know, late teens, early 20s, they were filled with as much existential angst as 20-somethings today.
Yeah, absolutely. You really see the parallels when you read their diaries and their journals, and a lot of them kept diaries and journals. The literacy rate is very high. So we have all these great documents from young men and young women who just moan in their diaries about how they can't figure out how to become adults. The whole world their parents grew up in has crumbled. You can't grow up the way that Europeans had grown up, or earlier Americans, or kind of rural, stable people had found their way into adulthood. But they're none of the institutions of the 20th and 21st century. There isn't a good school system. There aren't unions. There isn't a clear way to get a job or find a spouse or settle down. And so these young people really cast about. And some of them do really well. And, you know, the booms and busts, they get the booms, and it really benefits them. And some of them, you know, they essentially the equivalent of graduating into a recession. They really struggle to find themselves. But what they all share is uncertainty. No one knows how to become an adult. The old way is kind of crumbled, and the new way hasn't been established yet. And I think we see echoes of that today, that in many ways it seems as if in the 20th century there was a stable path into adulthood. And I'm a millennial. I think you count as a millennial too, right?
Right, yeah, barely.
Yeah, me too, barely. But we've seen this shaking in the last couple of decades that makes it harder to become an adult. And a lot of people struggle with this, and it's not unprecedented. This has happened before.
I'm curious. You said, you know, there's journal and diary entries. Do you? I don't know if you have one at hand, but is it like an excerpt from a journal from a young person?
Yeah,
that
sure.
You have that you could share with us?
Yeah, let me pull that up. And I'm going to read it. If it's too long,
no, that's fine.
Let me to read one part of it. So this is a diary from this guy Ben Foster, who lives in Maine. He's about 16 years old. He can't get an apprenticeship. He can't get a belle or a girlfriend. He's having trouble meeting women. He's having trouble getting a job. He really feels stuck, and he keeps his great diary. And he writes, "My life is probably a quarter or a fifth gone, and with what result? Leaving me ignorant, poor, fickle, wavering, without brilliancy, talents, wealth, or influential friends. A shuddering discontent that crawls over me when I reflect that I am learning nothing, earning nothing, doing nothing. I shrink to think of a time when I'm 21 and shall have no home to fall back upon in case of disappointment, when I must do or die." And he's really, he seems particularly depressed or worried, but he's really common. There's so many anxious, ambitious, striving young people who the culture is pushing them to succeed more and more. There's this kind of belief in progress that earlier generations didn't have, but there's no clear route to it. So they feel like they're failing individually, and they're looking for something to help them feel more like they have that agency and like they have that progress, even if they can't get a job or find a wife or whatever.
Right. So they couldn't find the path to adulthood in the marketplace because jobs were, they were in a transition in the economy. So it was tough, much like we are today. I guess some of the traditional, like the family part would maybe has fallen apart a little bit because people were becoming more mobile. So I guess they looked, I guess politics was the outlet. They could find a path to adulthood by taking an active part in politics.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think there's a slightly later quote. I don't want to quote too much, but from the same guy. He's moaning, he's whining, and then he goes out to a political rally and he talks to people about politics at this upcoming election, the 1848 election. And he goes home and writes in his diary, "I can say that nothing in some years, not intimately concerning myself, have I felt so much intense interest and excitement as a pending presidential election. I have talked and argued with men. I have endeavored to advance a boy's opinion with a boy's modesty. Oh, I wish that for one year on this one topic, I was a man, a voter." So before, when he's looking at his life, he's saying, "Oh, I can't imagine when I'm going to be 21 and I'm an adult. I have no idea what I'm going to do." He's terrified about it. And then a couple diary entries later, he's out at this rally and he's wishing that he's a man and a voter because politics seems like it offers him some kind of agency in his life that he doesn't see in any other world.
Right. And, you know, dovetailing off that, this idea of becoming a man, you argue in the book, make the case that politics wasn't just tied up with adulthood, but it was really tied up because men were the only ones that could vote at the time, was tied up with notions of manhood and masculinity in the 19th century. So like this, Ben, he felt he wasn't making a lot of progress in becoming a man. And I'm guessing, I mean, what it, besides just like the sense of agency, I mean, what did politics offer young men in terms of their conception of masculinity that they weren't getting from, say, their families or their church, for example?
The idea of masculinity back then is rooted in this idea of being stable, that the kind of the vision of men, and if you read, you see this a lot in kind of advice on young books for young men on how to grow up and in comics and in novels, the idea for young men is that they should be stable and self-controlled. That's what masculinity is all about. It's not necessarily physical strength. It's a father, a boss, somebody who is stable, has both feet on the ground, and has control over their instincts. They're not violent. They're not aggressive. They're completely in control of themselves. And this is very hard for an 18-year-old to do in that economy. One of the ways they can do that is have a stable connection to a political party. They might not have other identities. They might not have the job or the family, but they can be a Democrat or a Republican. They can be a voter and a citizen of the nation. And that's like, it's a great artificial way for them to feel that identity and stability that they associate with manhood. And at the same time, this political culture denies women that same sense. So there are a lot of women who are deeply interested in politics, but they're always unstable because they can never actually act. They can never vote. They can be very interested, and they are, and they can talk to their husbands and their children and their fathers about politics, and they can play a role, but because they can't vote, they're always somewhat unstable. They're never full citizens or adults in the eyes of the country in many ways.
And so were these young men and getting involved in politics, I mean, was it just the act of getting involved in politics that gave them a sense of that they were becoming a man? Or did a lot of them have aspirations to be, you know, work their way up through the party ranks and actually, you know, become part of the political machine in a way and find status or, I don't know, a sense of identity within the actual political party?
I think for a lot of these young guys, it's temporary, that there are people who want to make their lives in politics and become bosses and make money and a career in it. But a lot of them, they just need politics for a couple of years. And we know that young men in their late teens and early 20s are the most engaged in politics. And they can do things like, if you're Ben Foster, if you're this unstable kid in Maine, one thing you can do is you can join a political club. And then you're in this organization with 20, 30, 100 like-minded young people of the same party who are your age or a couple years older or a couple years younger, and you meet on weeknights or weekends, and you drink and you smoke cigars and you put on uniforms, you march down the middle of town square, and you have a camaraderie. It's a little bit like something along the lines of a fraternity or a gang or some sense that here are other men and we are all part of this club together. That's one way they get it. Another is through voting. And that act of casting a ballot when they turn 21 is seen as a gateway to real manhood and adulthood.
So your book's called The Virgin Vote, and that's what they called, it was referred to as a man's first vote, the virgin vote. Why was it such an important event in a young man's life?
Yeah, they use that phrase, the virgin vote. I was seeing that in diaries for years, and it just stuck in my head. It just says so much about how they saw politics, that man's first vote is his virgin vote or his maiden vote. And the idea is that he's losing his political virginity and he's supposed to be courted by a political party before that. And once he votes for that party, he's supposed to stay monogamous for life for that party. So you cast your first vote, your virgin vote. Not only does it make you a man, but it makes you a Democrat or a Republican or a Whig or what have you. And you stick with that party for life. And young men really treat this as the event, the rite of passage into adulthood. The younger kids kind of look forward to it and talk about when they become voters. Virgin voters went on the days before their election. A lot of times they try to grow out a beard or a mustache or some facial hair, and they try to dress up and look adult. And then once they've cast that vote, these guys talk about it for the rest of their life. You read their diaries, you read their memoirs when they're 80 years old, you read their obituaries, and it always mentions who they cast their first vote for.
Did you know Fast Growing Trees is the biggest online nursery in the U.S. with more than 10,000 different kinds of plants and over 2 million happy customers in the United States? They have everything you could possibly want, like fruit trees, palm trees, evergreens, houseplants, and so much more. Fast Growing Trees makes it easy to order online, and your plants are shipped directly to your door in 1 to 2 days. So I got a tree from Fast Growing Trees. I had a tree in my front yard that had it cut down, a big giant oak tree, because it died, and I wanted to put a maple tree there, one that turned bright red during the fall. So I found that tree, made sure that it fit the climate that we're at here in Tulsa, Oklahoma, ordered it. A few days later, I got the tree in a box. It's crazy they can send a tree in a box. And I planted it. A few weeks after I planted it, it's already starting to sprout leaves. So I think in a few years, I'm going to have that bright red maple tree that happens in the fall. I'm really looking forward to that. So if you want to try Fast Growing Trees out, this spring they have the best deals online, up to half off on select plants and other deals. And listeners to our show get an additional 15% off with their first purchase when using code manliness at checkout. That's an additional 15% off at fastgrowingtrees.com using code manliness at checkout. Fastgrowingtrees.com, code manliness. Offer is valid for a limited time. Terms and conditions may apply. Texas Pete is the sauce that allows you to sauce like you mean it. Each Texas Pete sauce is packed with a bold, balanced flavor. The signature tanginess is what makes it a legendary hot sauce that can be used on just about anything. You're definitely going to want to try every flavor. The original hot sauce has a famous secret blend of fermented peppers. Their hotter hot sauce is 3 times hotter than the original, and it's not for the faint of heart. They also got a flavor called Sabor by Texas Pete, adds authentic Mexican flavor. And they also have a dust dry seasoning that matches the flavor of the original hot sauce in a flavorful dry rub. But the flavor that I've been enjoying lately is the chopped sriracha sauce. It's got chili, garlic, and some tropical tangy notes. It's really good. I love putting on my eggs. Texas Pete, sauce like you mean it. Visit TexasPete.com and use the store locator to find Texas Pete products, as well as purchase sauces and get recipe inspiration. And you can use promo code PODCAST24 for 20% off at TexasPete.com. That's PODCAST24 for 20% off at TexasPete.com. Check out the Sriracha Cha Sauce. It's wedding season, and while weddings are all about the bride and groom, they're also a chance for you to look your best. With a fully custom suit from Indochino, you'll walk into wedding season looking like $1 million, even though suits start at just $499. It's easier than ever to be the best dressed with Indochino. Order your custom suits now and they'll be ready for wedding season. The process of customizing a suit on Indochino, very easy to do. It's also a lot of fun. I've talked about my navy blue suit I've gotten from Indochino. First off, you can decide how the jacket is, how you want the pockets on the jacket to be, how you want the lapels, the vent on the back, the lining on the pants. You can decide you want pleats or no pleats. I went no pleats on my pants on this one. And then you do the measuring process. You'll need someone to help you, but they have this very easy to follow guide. Send that all in a few weeks, you have a custom made-to-measure suit sent directly to your door, and you're going to pay about the same price for a suit that you'd pay for an off-the-rack suit at a department store. Look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com today and use code MANLINESS to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's Indochino.com, promo code MANLINESS. Check it out today. Have you ever been to an event where you just had to get the best seats? Like maybe it was a concert for your favorite band, or maybe it was an important game for your favorite team. Well, to do that, you had to set an alarm to get the tickets as soon as they went on sale. When you want the best, you have to act quickly, or someone else will get it instead. It's like if you are trying to hire for your business and you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. So what's the best way to do that? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast, and right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best people fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/manliness, MANLINESS. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
That's fascinating. And so I guess this is going back to the idea that American society, American culture was in flux, and rites of passages that may have existed before were no longer there. So young men, you know, used the political process, the act of making a vote, as that new rite of passage.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about it, culturally, America is an overwhelmingly white place at this time, and most of those white people come from the British Isles or Germany. They've given up on those old European traditions. African Americans have been separated from whatever traditions go back to Africa. Most cultures have some rites of passage, but America is this place in flux where those old, hundreds-year-old traditional rites of passage are being forgotten, and nobody remembers how you became a man in Germany or whatever. And so they need something new. And the one thing they all share throughout the country is the political process. And so American democracy becomes popular culture and offers this rite of passage to a nation that's forgotten its old ways to become an adult.
So how did the balloting system in the 19th century make a man's first vote all the more significant? Because I think a lot of people think now, oh, why is that so significant? Like you get this Scantron, right? And you just fill in the arrow and then you give it. But was there the way they did balloting back then, did that add to the significance of the vote in any way?
It's a great question. We've made the act of voting so clean and safe and dull that it's hard to imagine what it was like in the 19th century. The government didn't used to print ballots. Parties would print ballots. And what would happen is the men in a community would gather on election day in a town square or in a saloon or in a warehouse, and there'd be somebody at the front with a ballot box accepting ballots. And so these party activists would try to foist ballots on whoever they could for their party, and they'd line up and they'd try to vote. But the problem is, once you got to the front of the line, there's no registration system, but there are challengers, which are party operatives from both parties who are trying to challenge people's votes from the other side. So if I'm a Democrat, then I might try to pick out who looks like a Republican based on what I know about the people in my community, his clothes, his accent, his race, his background, all of these things, to try to figure out who's going to vote the way I don't want them to. And I might challenge them on legal grounds. I might try to intimidate them. I might stab them. They used to stab people with awls, like the shoemaker's spike, because you could kind of subtly poke somebody with that and it would hurt them, and threaten them without becoming a big thing. So because it's so contested, because there are fights on election days and everyone is gathered and there's music and drunk people, it makes this act of voting even more of an important rite of passage. All the men in your community will see you vote, and they'll see you go up to the front of the line and cast your ballot. And all the women in your community will hear about it and know that you've done this thing that supposedly makes you a man back then. So it really because voting was so different and because it was so contested, it makes the act that much more important.
Right. And going back to they didn't have, you know, official IDs, like a lot of people didn't even know their actual birthday. And
yeah.
And so you had the, like, that's one of the reasons why they, these young guys would start trying to grow mustaches and beards, because one of the ways that they were challenged was like, well, you're not old enough to vote. And so they tried to look older. And so by the act of voting, like, it was a way of being able to, for the community to say, yeah, you are a man. Like, you are, you look old enough to be a man. We accept you as a man.
Yeah, because who knows? I mean, this world is so shaken up that, okay, so you might be 21, but your mother died of cholera, so she can't tell anybody how old you are. Maybe you were born in Pennsylvania and moved to Oklahoma, so no one remembers where you were born. You might not even know how old you are. Most people don't. So, and you certainly can't prove it, even if you do. So you need to prove it through, can grow a beard, so I guess you can vote. You can get somebody to kind of vouch for you. If you've done a impressive manly deed in some communities, you could get the vote. So if you lived in kind of a pioneer community in Nebraska or Colorado or California, often you could vote underage just because they thought, well, you got to California, you're worth, you can vote. Soldiers could often vote at 18 or 17 just because they were a good soldier during the Civil War. But yeah, because nobody really knows how old you are, and because it's so hard to enforce, it makes the act of voting that much more important and that much more meaningful about adulthood and manliness as well as politics.
Right. And then you also talk about, you know, with the newly freed African-American slaves who were voting for the Republican Party, there's a lot of voter intimidation. So like black men in the community, like, they'd get together as a group and make sure they had revolvers, make sure they had knives, and they'd go together to vote to avoid that intimidation. And sometimes there, you know, things came to a blow.
Yeah. And it reminds you, or reminds me, not to be too light about all this political violence, because it seems like it was so far away and we can, you know, it sounds interesting and exciting and kind of exotic, but you have to remember these elections turned into race riots and massacres. And these are the bloodiest elections in American history in the South in the years after the Civil War. And there's a huge number of African Americans who are voting for the first time, and they're deciding elections. Ulysses S. Grant is elected in 1868 because he has black vote on his side. And so these become really contested places. There are organizations like the Union League, which is a club of African Americans, especially in Mississippi and Alabama, who they all go to vote together and bring revolvers, whether obviously or kind of hidden, and often they need them. So yeah, this political violence really affects who gets to vote and what voting means. And it's true for other minorities too. It's especially true for Irish Catholics in northern cities, where there's a Protestant majority who really doesn't want Catholics voting. And so they often have to fight their ways to the polls too.
Right. And then, you know, going back to, you know, there's a lot of club formation during the, this wasn't just unique to politics. Like, you just, young people at the time were just forming clubs about everything. But you talk about within the individual parties, there were these sort of like sub clubs of young party supporters. And I think one you mentioned that I thought was really fascinating was the Wide Awakes.
Oh yeah.
And it was kind of like, it's actually kind of scary when you, like, you describe like what they were. I mean, they would get in these like uniforms and they'd, look kind of like knights almost. And they would, carry torches at night. And like, the reason why they were called Wide Awakes, they'd go to people's houses in the middle of the night and like keep them, you know, bang pots and pans or things.
Yeah. I mean, when we think of Abraham Lincoln's election, we think of kind of upstanding, honest Abe. And we imagine this honest, tall, kind of earnest, statesman. Abe Lincoln's election is organized by this movement called the Wide Awakes, which comes out of Connecticut. The leader of the whole national movement is 23 years old. And what they do are, they're young men who dress up in really military uniforms, black capes and black hats, and they march in the street, and they basically take over the North. There are tens, if not hundreds of thousands of them from Maine to San Francisco and into some southern states. And they're seen, for Northern Republicans who support Abe Lincoln, they're seen as this godsend, that the North is going to finally stand up for their rights. If you're a Southerner who doesn't like Abe Lincoln, this looks like the beginning of a political war. It looks like a paramilitary movement. And so this movement actually affects the beginning of the Civil War because it seems so threatening. These young men in uniform marching at night, well, that doesn't seem so great if you're not on their side. Oh, and that also, because politics is so competitive, because the races are so neck and neck, everybody steals everybody's ideas. So there, the wide awakes are created, and almost immediately Lincoln's opponents all have similar organizations with different names. So no party ever really has an edge for very long, because as soon as one group of 18-year-olds tries something, their opponents across town try the same thing. Or if they're doing it in Maine, someone in South Carolina comes up with something similar. So because politics is so close and so contested back then, and Lincoln only won that election with 39% of the popular vote, people really rip off each other's ideas.
Yeah. So we was thinking about the adults who were actually running for these offices that these young people were campaigning for. What did these adults think of these ardent young people? I mean, did they leverage them and they just sort of like at the same time disdain them?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. It's a hierarchical society still, and adults think they are better and wiser and smarter than young people. But no matter how great they think they are, the parties need young people. Because elections are so close, and because there's so few independents, because most people who pick a party, their virgin vote, stick with a party, the only way to gain any ground is to bring in new members. And new members are young members. So these parties realize pretty quickly that they really need to bring in 21-year-olds. So they organize events to be entertaining for young voters. They reach out to children and youths, because they know that if they win over a 15-year-old, maybe in 6 years, that 15-year-old will vote for their party. And they focus a ton of time and money on entertaining and reaching out to and recruiting young men and young women, because they know young women have an influence on the young men in their lives. So while governing in Washington or in state capitals is done by these 60-year-old guys, campaigning is done by 18, 20, 22-year-olds. And the parties know that, and they know it's their best shot at victory.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess at the same time, though, they just kind of like, ugh, you know, because it seems like a lot of the politicians you described in the book, they kept the distance from actual campaigning because they didn't want to sully themselves. So they left it to these young men to do it for them.
Yeah, I think there are two attitudes towards young voters then and now, honestly, and we see this throughout American history. On the one hand, there are some people who look down at young people and see them as self-involved or flighty and not committed and not knowledgeable and kind of disdain young people. And then there are those who think that young people are purer, smarter, somehow going to uplift the democracy and solve all the problems. And obviously both are exaggerations. But yeah, you see people go back and forth. Some people see young voters as the way to destroy the other party or clean up politics when it's very, very dirty in the late 19th century. And others say they'll accept young people's votes, but they're not going to listen to them in terms of party platforms or nominations or anything like that.
So in the book, a lot of the focus is on men, obviously, because like they're the ones who could vote. But you argue that women also used the political culture of the 19th century to advance personal goals or personal ambitions. So how were they able to do that when they weren't allowed to vote?
For women's politics back then, they have to be social. The democracy is social, and women's influence has to depend on connections to men, because they obviously can't vote themselves. And that works both ways. On the one hand, there are women with really deeply held political beliefs, and what they can do is they can pressure their fiancé to go vote for their political belief. And they can push their siblings and the men in their lives to vote, and they do. And then there are women who use politics as a tool, just as men are using politics as a tool. So it's a great way to court. If you want to meet some young guy, you go out to a political rally. If you want to get the attention of someone who's in a political club, well, if you talk about with him about the party he supports, that's a great way to engage with him. And politics kind of gives these Victorian women cover to court in a way they otherwise wouldn't be able to. They can go up. Where else in 19th century America could a Victorian lady go out at midnight and hang out with a bunch of drunk people and maybe get drunk herself and, you know, wave a torch and everything? It offers some kind of cover for that. And women get more directly involved. They organize women's clubs, and they march dressed as goddesses or dressed as the different states. So there are a lot of ways women can play a role socially, even though they're denied the right to vote.
So this the period you cover was about, I guess, 1840 till about the early, 1905. And it seems like there's this precipitous drop. That was something that amazed me. What can you describe the drop in, I guess, voter turnout from like the peak it was there in the late 19th century to like the early 20th century?
Yeah, it really crashed. Throughout the second half of the 19th century, roughly 80% of eligible voters will turn out in an election, in a presidential election. Sometimes it's lower, sometimes it's higher, but there's this really sustained period of really high level of involvement. And then something happens in 1900, and those numbers tumble in almost every presidential election until by the 1920s, fewer than half of eligible voters are going to the poll. There's this political culture that exists in the 19th century that just dies within a generation in the 20th century. And we've known this as historians for a while, but I think the answer to why this happens lies with young people. There's a new generation of young people who don't engage in politics and look to politics in the same ways as their parents or their grandparents had, and they don't join. So people who cast their virgin vote in 1876 will keep turning out for the rest of their lives, but the people who could vote for Teddy Roosevelt or Taft don't care as much, and they don't bother to.
And so, I mean, what changed in American culture where young people just, they weren't looking to politics anymore for personal fulfillment or a sense of identity?
I'd say there's a change with young people and there's a change with politics. With young people, life is easier for a lot of these people in the 20th century than in the 19th. There are more institutions that kind of stabilize their world. They have a full school system until they're 18. They have unions. They have cities where they know more people. They have all these other options. They have an entertainment culture. They're teenagers in the 20th century, and they have movies and radio and dance halls and cars and all these other entertainment forms. So in many ways, they don't have the same need for politics and political clubs that they did before. I mean, their lives are, they still have their challenges, and life is still difficult for many of them. I don't want to be too exaggerate with this, but yeah, the death rate goes down. Young people are living longer and they're healthier, and they have less need. So there are fewer of them turning to politics. At the same time, the political parties, there's a real revolution in who runs the parties, in that in the 19th century, campaigning is run by kind of working class men who, you know, they might run a saloon or a butcher shop, and they organize campaigning. There's a switch in the end of this period where these kind of upper middle class reformers take over politics. And the one thing they really don't like is these crowds of drunk, you know, working class men in the street. So one thing they try to do is they try to shut down this public campaigning that attracts so many young people.
And I think that's interesting, the cultural change where there's more outlets. I guess America became more of a peer culture. Young people began looking to their peers instead of, I guess, some of the political parties or the political process. They were kind of looking up to older people into sort of ushering them into adulthood as these outlets, like, you know, talk about sports, you talk about the amusement park, you talk about, you know, high schools where you have the same kids who are your age. They start turning to their identity and sense of fulfillment instead of older people to give that to them.
I think that's really important that we forget how mixed life used to be in terms of age groups, and that if you went into a saloon in 19th century America, there'd be 15-year-olds, and there'd be 12-year-olds, and there'd be 30-year-olds, and there'd be 80-year-olds. So society mixed more in churches and political organizations and work. They just spent more time with other age groups. In the 20th century, the age groups separate out a lot more. So political parties still have youth organizations, but there's an age limit on them. No one over 21 joins the youth organizations anymore. So these young people who want to meet adults who can benefit their career or give them a sense of manhood or whatever, they don't meet these people anymore. They're isolated with their own age group, and there's not really the same selling point. If politics is removed from kind of personal ambition, why should young people care?
Right. And then going back to the change in the political process, I mean, you make the case that the introduction of the Australian ballot, where it was, you know, a state-sponsored ballot, like the kind we have today, took away some of the significance of the virgin vote or that first-time vote that young people in the 19th century have and that we really don't have anymore.
Yeah. I mean, voting machines are kind of a physical example of what happens. When there's a ballot box, everyone stands around the ballot box and tries to put the ballot in the box, and there's, you know, conflicts over that. When it's a voting machine and you go off by yourself behind a curtain and you vote with this electric device or mechanical device, it's a really different culture. It says politics isn't social, politics is private. And that's one of the big changes. This kind of public political culture goes away, and politics becomes something you're not supposed to talk about at the dinner table. that really saps the interest. It doesn't really benefit young people, and they're kind of cut off from it in a way after that.
Right. And that's not to say, I mean, like, there were benefits. There were reasons why they made these reforms, you know, avoid corruption, voter fraud. But yeah, in the process, you lose something. With any reform you make, you lose something.
Yeah, there's a trade-off between big, loud, popular democracy and smaller, quieter, cleaner democracy. And there's a huge amount of corruption and a huge amount of problems with 19th century democracy. This is not in any way a golden age, and I certainly wouldn't want to have to vote back then. But there's a trade-off, and as they clean it up, they lose some of the popularity.
But do you say with this current election, I mean, I guess maybe the rise of social media and people sort of spout their political opinions on social media, are we seeing the reemergence of, you know, bringing back that sociability into politics again?
Well, yeah, for good and for bad, I right. see some of that. I mean, one of the things that powered 19th century politics are newspapers, and the thousands of newspapers in the country, and people cut out articles and they reprint them almost the way we do with links and sharing things today. So there's this idea that there's a social conversation about an election, which we have again today, as opposed to the 20th century when there are a couple media outlets who control it.
And I'm curious, you know, a lot of people get this idea because I have like John L. Sullivan, I have like this retro vibe on The Art of Manliness that I'm like nostalgizing the past and, and that I want to bring back, you know, go back to the 19th century or something, but I don't. But I'm always curious, like there's always things you could probably learn from the past. I'm curious if there's anything we can learn from this very, this period of an American history where political activity was high that maybe we could bring back in some way or another.
Yeah, I completely agree. We don't want to bring back.
I don't want to get shanked when I go to the ballot, you know, make a vote. Right.
Yeah, I completely agree. And we want everybody being allowed to vote. But there are some things they are really good at, and they're really good at engaging people, particularly young people. And I think they do that through two ways we could think about today. One is that the way they view politics, they view the political as personal. Voting isn't just about issues. It's not just about civic duty. It's not just kind of about the better good, the greater good. It's about young people, personal engagement with politics. And voting means so much to them as individuals, and they use it in their lives. You see, they're not just voting because of the issues, but they're voting because they need politics in their lives. So they make the political personal that way. The other thing is this idea that democracy is social, that you don't just vote because of your own individual views, but you vote because of the world you've grown up in and the society you've grown up in. And we see this today. Political scientists have shown that people who grow up around voters are more likely to vote. People who grow up in households where people talk politics are more likely to vote. You don't just decide on your own whether you're going to be engaged or not, or how you're going to be engaged. It's really promoted by your role models and the world around you. And I think that's something we could think about again. There's a tendency to kind of shake your finger at young people and say, oh, they don't vote, why don't they care? But every young person who's not voting is the result of the adults in their life not introducing them to politics.
Okay. Well, John Greenspan, this has been a really fascinating discussion because, like I said, this was really one of the most fascinating books I've read so far this year. Just so interesting.
Thank you.
To read this part of American history. Well, John Greenspan, thank you so much for your time. This has been an absolute pleasure.
Oh, yeah, Brett. Thanks for having me.
My guest today was John Greenspan. He's the author of the book, The Virgin Vote, How Young Americans Made Democracy Social, Politics Personal, and Voting Popular in the 19th Century. And it's available on Amazon.com and bookstores everywhere. And be sure to check out the show notes at aom.is/virginvote for links to resources we mentioned so you can delve deeper into this topic. Well, that wraps up another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. For more manly tips and advice, make sure to check out the Art of Manliness website at artofmanliness.com. And if you enjoy this podcast and have gotten something out of it, I'd really appreciate it if you give us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. Help spread the word about the show. As always, I appreciate your continued support. And until next time, this is Brett McKay telling you to stay manly.
Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. With Capella University's game-changing FlexPath learning format, you gain relevant skills you can apply to your career right away. Earn your degree from an accredited university and be confident in the quality of your education. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. Capella University is accredited by the Higher Learning Commission. Learn more at capella.edu/accreditation.
On this episode of Plant Killers, we'll explore one nation's most notorious fruit and vegetable killer, bad dirt. What makes bad dirt so bad? The answer? The ingredients. But fear not, true crime enthusiasts. This story has a happy ending. New Miracle-Gro Organic Raised Bed and Garden Soil. It's made with quality organic ingredients from upcycled green waste like compost and aged bark. Unlike the other guys, who can't say the same. Looks like bad dirt's murdering days are over, thanks to Miracle-Gro. Join us next time on Plant Killers.